This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner on bees. And this is Lecture 7, given in Dornach on December 15, 1923. Good morning, gentlemen. Today I would like to continue the subject we were talking about, the one that followed from Mr. Dollinger's question last time. If other questions arise, we can try to take care of those too. Last time, in order to answer this question, I began discussing ants. We can say that they are related to bees, since they belong to the same order, bees, wasps, and ants. The only difference, as we observe them, is in their manner of living. From all of this, we can actually learn a great deal that can be useful for managing things here on Earth. For the more you investigate these creatures and the manner in which they live, the more you will come to the conclusion that there is great wisdom in how they work and what they accomplish. Last time I told you how ants build their nests and how they make their little mounds out of tiny fragments procured from the soil, from decaying or dead wood, and also from other construction materials that they put into this mix. Then they construct their earth mounds. In these mounds there are a variety of corridors through which they move in great numbers, in the form of processions. You can see them emerging from their holes and going different places to collect the things they want to collect. Sometimes these creatures do not first build nests, but rather use what is already there. Assume, for instance, that someone has cut down a tree. The stump of the tree that has been removed remains in the ground. Then an ant colony comes along, bores into the stump, and creates a chamber, and also bores all the passageways that lead outside. They may even add soil to the structure as they build one passageway on top of another. These are all interconnected, thus creating a complete maze of corridors, Table 10, page 166. Through these corridors, the ants move and bring from the vicinity what they need for food and for the structure of the nest. You see, gentlemen, it's all very fine simply to say that these ants do all these things instinctively, but in saying this, you really haven't said much. For if the ant doesn't have available to it such a tree stump, it proceeds to make a sand hill type of nest. If it finds an appropriate tree stump, it saves itself the unnecessary work of constructing an earth mound nest. The ant adjusts its work methods to suit the individual situations that exist. This makes it difficult to maintain the opinion that it has a general instinctive behavior. Such behavior would mean that it does everything according to its instincts. But the ant is able to adjust its activities according to the changing external circumstances. This is what is important. This may not happen here very much, but as soon as you go to other regions lying farther south, ants can become a pest and cause considerable trouble. Imagine a house where, in an unfrequented corner, ants have taken up residence, have carried in all sorts of things from the vicinity, grains of soil, tiny pieces of wood, and have constructed a chamber unnoticed by the homeowner, who hasn't cleaned the corner in a long time. Then they extend their passageways to the kitchen and the pantry, using very complicated routes, and they retrieve their food from those areas. Such a house in southern regions can become completely penetrated by one ant nest. You may not be aware that you are sharing your home with an ant colony, and you'll notice it only by chance when you discover that something in the pantry has been nibbled at and you follow the trail back to its source. Here, too, the word instinct doesn't explain much. Otherwise, you could say that nature has put instinct into these creatures to create their nest structure in that specific house. It would have to be made in just such a way that it would fit into the particular house. So you see, these creatures don't act according to pure instinct. There is instead a wisdom present in them. But if you examine a single ant all by itself, you would not come to the conclusion that it is particularly wise. That which the ant does under these conditions, or what you have it do, completely separated from its colony, does not have the appearance of any great wisdom. The result is that you have to consider the possibility that it's not the individual ant that has intelligence, but rather the entire ant colony. Likewise, it is the entire beehive that is wise. The individual ants in the colony are not the ones that possess this intelligence. As a colony, however, the ants work in an extremely wise manner. There is still much I would like to say about even more interesting things that happen. There is another type of ant that does the following. Somewhere on the ground it constructs a rather high mound. Then it forms a circle surrounded by soil. Then burrows into the ground. In there are the ants. Sometimes this mound can turn out to look like a volcano. Inside are the passageways that radiate into the surrounding area. Well, these ants then engage in a very unusual action. They bite away and destroy all the grasses and plants that grow on the area they claim, with the exception of one type of grass. Footnote: Aristida stricta and Aristida olegantha. Aristida means needle grass. Both varieties are called ant rice. End of footnote. Anything else they continually destroy. Sometimes they bite away and destroy everything, so that all that is left is the hill, and around it an area that appears to be paved. This area appears paved because soil becomes more compact as all living plants are removed from it. It becomes very smooth and begins to look like asphalt pavement, only much lighter in color. Now, these ants go out farther into the surrounding area to find and bring back a specific grass, which they then plant. As soon as the wind blows other seeds into their cleared area and they begin to sprout, the ants very quickly bite off whatever appears above ground and carry it away from the nest and the area they have prepared. So it is that nothing can grow in this area except this single type of grass. The ants have laid claim to a parcel of land and have planted on it only what suits them. The grass that they grow has a very different appearance when you compare it with the same grass growing elsewhere. Usually this grass grows in a loose soil. That's why it has a different appearance. The soil that the ants have prepared is very hard, so that the grass that grows there produces extremely hard seeds, seeds as hard as a pebble. Table 10. Yes, gentlemen, you can find such ant colonies. These are agricultural ants. I'm going to attempt this. The name is Atta malefaciens, and the malefaciens, I'm going to say, or malefaciens or whatever, is M-A-L-E-F-A-C-I-E-N-S. Malefaciens, maybe. That tend the fields around them. This is what Darwin, who has studied them carefully, calls them. You'll find the entire farm, the land, as well as the extremely hard seeds. Then, when their crop is ready, the ants come out, bite off the portion above ground, and carry it back into the hill. For a while they remain in there, and you don't see them, but they are busy inside their anthill. Everything that they can't use, that might be attached to the seed, they bite off. After a while they come out again, go over and beyond their field to dump whatever they don't need and keep the pebble-hard seeds, some of which they break open with their extremely hard jaws and eat, and others of which they used to plant in their field. They are truly farmers. They look at things nearby to see if they can use them. Whatever they can't use, they throw out. After all, we don't do these things much differently. These agricultural ants work with great precision with those things that they need for themselves. When you think about the way these endeavors are carried out, you may ask yourself, what is really going on here? You see, a new type of grass is actually being created. These seeds that are like pebble-hard rice kernels don't exist anywhere else. They are created by these ants, which use them as part of a process that is repeated over and over again. What is really happening? Before we try to answer this question, let's look at this matter from another perspective. Let's go back to the wasps. There we'll find, as I've told you, creatures that lay their eggs in leaves or bark, out of which the so-called gall apples are formed, from which young wasps will eventually emerge. This can also take place differently. There are caterpillars that look like this. He draws on the blackboard, see table 10, upper right. All of you, I'm sure, are acquainted with this type of caterpillar, covered with thick, bristly hair. This is what can happen to such a caterpillar. one or more wasps of a certain type can come and lay their eggs directly into the caterpillar, ichneumon or ichneumon fly. When the eggs mature, the larvae emerge from these eggs. These larvae are the first form that the wasps take. Even bees and other insects of this type appear in this way. With ants it is also similar. You know, if you scratch away at an anthill long enough, you'll find the so-called ant eggs, which some people use as food for certain songbirds. However, these ant eggs are not really eggs, but chrysalises. The eggs are small, and from these eggs the first thing to emerge are the larvae. It is incorrect to call these chrysalises ant eggs. What happens when the wasp lays its eggs in the caterpillar is a very remarkable matter. I've already told you about it once before, footnote C, The Brain and Thinking, entitled Health and Illness, Volume 2, Anthroposophic Press, Spring Valley, New York, 1983. End of footnote. The larvae that emerge from the eggs are voracious eaters. But now, remember that there are countless larvae in this single caterpillar. With their voracious appetites, these larvae get their nourishment from the caterpillar's body. And here a very strange thing occurs. As soon as one of the wasp larvae begins eating the caterpillar's stomach, the entire mass of young wasps is doomed to a certain premature death. They are not able to continue living. If anything like an eye, EYE, a heart-like organ or a similar organ were to serve as nourishment for the larva, or even be nibbled at, life, for all concerned, could not continue. These tiny wasp larvae demonstrate an understanding that directs them not to nibble at anything that the caterpillar needs for its continued existence. They eat only those organs that can be injured, yet continue to exist for a long time in an impaired condition. The creature does not die. It will at most be sick. And so the wasp larva can continue eating inside the caterpillar. This arrangement, that these wasp larvae simply will not bite into anything that could cause the caterpillar to die directly, has been established with great wisdom. Perhaps you have even seen this phenomenon, how the larvae emerge when they have matured sufficiently. They crawl out after the caterpillar has served with its entire body as a foster mother for the whole brood. They crawl out, develop into ichneumon flies, and seek out their nourishment from flowers and similar plants. And then, when they are mature enough, they will, in turn, place their eggs into similar caterpillars. Now, you could say that there is really something very intelligent in all of this. And indeed, as I've told you, your astonishment will become greater the more you begin to observe these matters more carefully. You begin to marvel and then ask yourself what the connections are among all these things. Now, let's now get to the bottom of all of this. First, we tell ourselves that there are the flowers that grow out of the ground. There are caterpillars present. Now, these insects come and gorge themselves with what they find in the form of flowers and caterpillars. Then they propagate themselves. This same story begins anew again and again. On the surface, it appears that this entire insect world could disappear, and it would be no great loss for us as human beings. When we look at the bee, we say as human beings, quote, the bees produce honey for us, and for this reason beekeeping is useful to us. Fine, but that is looking at the whole matter only from the standpoint of human beings. If it turns out that bees can be considered robbers that simply take the honey away from the flowers, and we can then use this honey for nourishment or even curing diseases, the whole matter is considered to be very favorable from our viewpoint. But if you look at it from the viewpoint of the flowers, it would appear to be simply robbery, with human beings acting as accessories to the crime. You also must ask whether, from the standpoint of the flowers, you need to say, as they would, that out there are all these robbers, bees, wasps, ants, who take our juice away, and we would be able to grow and thrive much better if they didn't do this to us. This is the standpoint that we assume the flowers would have. You can hear endless lamentations expressed by unknowledgeable people who say, oh, these poor flowers, and these poor creatures, the caterpillars. These terrible parasites attack and eat them up. They do all sorts of things to remove substances from the flowers. This is not, however, the way things really are. Not at all. The situation is quite different from what you might think. If you come up close to a flower, and you see an insect, let's say a bee, sitting on it, and sucking up the juice contained in the flower or willow blossom, you must ask yourself what would happen to the plant if the bee, wasp, or other insect did not come to the plant and remove the juice from it. This is a more difficult question than the one concerning the simple act of robbery. You need to take a deep look into the entire ecology that nature has to offer. And here, it is also true that you will not be able to form any meaningful opinion unless you can look back into the conditions that prevailed in much earlier periods of the Earth's development. The Earth was not always the way we see it today. If the Earth had always been as it is now, with its dead limestone, dead quartz, dead gneiss, dead mica schist, with its plants sprouting from present-day seeds, and with the animals and so on, if the Earth had always been this way, then the whole thing could not exist at all. Nothing could exist at all. The people who take their knowledge only from what exists today have allowed themselves to be completely deceived, for this Earth could not exist all by itself. Gentlemen, that person who seeks the secrets of the Earth and wishes to know how things conform with the natural laws of Earth, but who uses the same sources and methods that contemporary science does, is like a visitor from Mars who would come to Earth and have no interest in living human beings, but would prefer to go into a morgue and examine the corpses there. These corpses could not exist if they had not first been living human beings. You would first have to lead such a Martian, who had never before seen living human beings and was looking only at corpses, to two living human beings, and point them out to the Martian. Then the Martian would say, "Well, now I understand why the corpses have this particular form. Earlier I could not understand it, because I was not yet acquainted with the living form that had preceded it." And so it is necessary to go back to earlier conditions if you want to understand the laws that govern the Earth's development. You see, a completely different form of the Earth preceded the one we have now. I've always called it the moon formation stage. See my title outline of Esoteric Science. Because the present-day moon is the leftover portion of the older Earth. Likewise, other conditions of the Earth preceded that one. The Earth has gone through transformations, and originally it took a very different form. There once was on Earth a stage or condition where such plants and insects as we have them now did not exist at all. The situation was this. There was that which you might be able to compare to the present-day Earth. Growing out of it were, let's say, plant-like formations, but of a type that continually changed their shapes, in a manner similar to the way clouds do. Around the Earth there were clouds such as these. He draws on the blackboard, table 10, lower right. But they were not like our clouds today, which appear to be dead. On the contrary, they were living clouds, as alive as our plants are today. If you could imagine our clouds taking on life and turning greenish in color, then you would have an imaginative picture of what the plant kingdom looked like back then. If you think that this is quite strange, then in this regard I might mention that there are some gentlemen in the field of science who are very funny. Recently you could read an article in the newspaper that might make you chuckle. Once again a new scientific discovery was being described in a style typical of today's science reporters. The scientist had determined that if milk has been prepared in a special way, it can be used to heal scurvy, a rather ugly disease. Well, gentlemen, what does such a scientist do nowadays? I've already directed your attention to this matter earlier. The scientist analyzes the milk. He discovers that milk consists of certain chemical ingredients. I also mentioned to you that if you give mice milk containing all these chemical ingredients, they will derive their nourishment from it and continue to live. But if you give them the ingredients separately, they will die after only a few days. This is what Professor Bunge's students also found out. So they said to themselves, "There is simply this other element necessary for life right there in the milk, and also in the honey. Let's call it a vitamin." You remember I gave you this example once before. It's just as if you had said, "Poverty is due to pauperism." Likewise, they say here that there is a vitamin in the milk. So they made a big discovery, In milk there are all sorts of chemical elements and compounds with very scholarly-sounding names. And it is a fact that milk, prepared in a certain way, can be used to cure scurvy. But using a very learned scientific method, they wanted to determine if you could heal scurvy by giving separately to patients who are sick with scurvy all these things with scholarly names attached to them. Well, they were not healed of anything, most of all not of scurvy. And this was true despite the fact that the patients were given all the constituents of milk. But when all the parts are kept together in this specially prepared milk, then they can cure a person of scurvy. Each constituent by itself does not heal. Only the total, containing all the elements, is capable of healing. What is it that remains? The scientist conducting the experiment asks, if you remove separately all the constituents. The scientist subtracts each part one by one until nothing remains, but does not allow for the fact that these constituents are all contained in an etheric body. The scientist continues removing all the parts. And what remains? By this account, it is a vitamin. The vitamin that heals scurvy is not contained in anything that has been removed. So where is it? These people come with a nice idea. It's in the water that is in the milk, because it is not in all the other things that have been chemically analyzed. The conclusion, then, is that water is the missing compound that actually heals scurvy. This is really quite funny, but today it is considered a very learned way of determining the truth. For if the water contains the vitamin, then we have come just about far enough with scholarly scientific thinking that we could allow the clouds to be considered alive, because then we would have to look outside and say that everywhere that there is water, there would also be vitamins in the water. We will have arrived at the point when the earth was the way I have described it to you. The only problem is that it no longer is that way today. Back then, there was something I would like to call a planthood, a plant being, a single living covering of plants. And this living plant cover was fertilized everywhere by the surrounding environment. There also were no animals fixed in definite forms. No wasps existed either. But instead, out of the environment, there arose only a substance that had lived in an animal way. Our earth once was in a condition that might be described this way. It was surrounded by clouds that contained plant life, and approaching these clouds from the periphery were other clouds. These other clouds, which were of an animal nature, fertilized the plant life clouds. The animalhood came from the cosmos, whereas the planthood came out of the earth. All of this has changed. The plants of that earlier time have become our flowers, with their definite shapes and forms, flowers that now grow out of the earth and do not form large clouds anymore. But something remained with these flowers, the fact that they want to experience an influence that comes to them from the environment. There, for example, is a rose that grows out of the earth. There's a drawing on the blackboard, table 11, page 166, left. There is one rose leaf, and there is another, and so on. Then a wasp comes up to the rose. The wasp gnaws or cuts a piece out of the leaf, carries it back to its nest, and uses it to build or to give to its young ones for nourishment. The wasp simply bites off a piece and carries it away. As I've said, our rose plants today are no longer clouds. They have become in shape and form very sharply delineated things. But that part of the plant which once lived in the clouds and was connected with that which came to it from all directions in the form of animal nature, has, despite everything that has occurred in the meantime, remained in the rose's leaves and blossoms. It is situated right in there. In every rose leaf there is something that can do no other but be fertilized by the entire environment. You see, gentlemen, these flowers need, which they very definitely require, a chemical substance that also plays an important role in the human body. If you analyze the human body chemically, you'll find various chemical substances. All these substances undergo continual changes. But everywhere these substances eventually are transformed into something that is always present in the human body, The human body needs this substance, which is formic acid. If you go out to an anthill, collect ants and squeeze them, you'll get a juice. This juice contains formic acid and some alcohol. This is the juice that is in ants. But you too have this juice very thinly distributed throughout your body. Whatever you eat, as long as you are alive, will always be changed, not exclusively, since there are other substances in smaller quantities, to formic acid. This formic acid fills your entire body. When you are ill and don't have sufficient formic acid, this situation is in itself something very bad for the body. But then your body will tend, just because it does not have enough formic acid in it, now I'm coming back to Mr. Müller's question to give an answer to it, the body will tend to show signs of gout or rheumatism. The body is creating too much uric acid and not enough formic acid. So it is that ants have in themselves the same thing that human beings need. But formic acid is, on the whole, something that is needed throughout all of nature. You won't be able to find the bark of any tree that doesn't contain some formic acid. Throughout the tree, just as throughout the human body, you'll find formic acid everywhere. In each leaf, there has to be formic acid. However, it is not only formic acid that must be in there, but something related to formic acid, which is what wasps and also bees have within themselves, a chemical substance that they transform into bee poison. All these insects carry in themselves a certain chemical substance that is poisonous. If a bee stings you, you'll get an inflammation. If a wasp stings you, well, then some of you would have a rather bad experience. The entire matter of wasp stings is quite bad. Brehme relates an interesting episode that illustrates how such insects can play a terrible trick on both humans and animals. This is close to how the story was told. A cowherd, still rather young, had quite a few cows in a pasture, and in this pasture there were various insect nests in many places. The cowherd's dog ran in circles. Suddenly the dog went crazy, and the cowherd had no idea what was wrong. The dog ran as fast as possible to a brook, jumped in, and kept shaking himself. The cowherd was completely bewildered by the dog's actions and tried to help him, but he came from another direction. He didn't jump into the brook, but tried to help the dog from the other side. Unfortunately, he had taken up a position on top of an insect nest, as very likely the dog also had done, and the insects began stinging him. Then he too ran around wildly and finally jumped into the brook as well. Since both the cowherd and the dog were gone, the cows gradually became confused and began to move about. Those cows that stepped on the insect nests were also stung and acted as if they were crazy. Finally, the greater portion of the herd ended up in the brook. Such insect stings can really create havoc. After all, these insects have something poisonous in them. And finally, if you are bitten by an ant, there will also be a slight inflammation, because the ant will allow some formic acid to flow into the wound. Once again, formic acid is present in all living things, in just the appropriate dilution. Gentlemen, if there were no ants, no bees, and no wasps, those that actually prepare these poisons, what would happen? The very same thing would happen that would occur with the propagation of human beings if you suddenly decided to behead all men and allow only women to continue to exist here on earth. Humanity would not be able to continue to propagate because there would be no male seed. Well, these insects all still have some additional seed. Nevertheless, what comes from these poisons has become necessary for their continued life. This is because these poisons have been left over from that which used to be in the environment of the old moon. Very finely distributed bee poison, wasp poison, and formic acid, ant poison, originated in the cosmos and came down over the plants. What remains of it is still present today. If you go out and see a bee sitting somewhere on a willow tree or on a flower, then you don't say that the insect is simply robbing the flower. Instead, you say that while the little bee is sitting on it and obtaining nectar, the flower is having such a pleasant experience that it sends its own plant juice toward the place where the bee is sucking it out. This is very interesting, gentlemen. As the bee is sucking, the flower allows its juice to flow to that spot. And in this same stream of flowing juice, while the bee is removing something from the flower, bee poison also flows in the opposite direction from the bee to the flower. And while the gall wasp is stinging, wasp poison flows into the plant. And in particular, when an ant crawls over a plant, even over the dead portion of it, like the bark, it allows formic acid to flow into it. When an ant crawls on a flower, flower juice combines with formic acid. This is necessary. If this didn't happen, and if there weren't any bees, wasps, and ants, which continually come into contact with the world of flowers and nibble at them, then the necessary formic acid and the other necessary poisons wouldn't flow toward these flowers, and the flowers would have to die out after a certain period of time. You see, such chemicals, normally called the substances of life, well, these are highly treasured above all others, but in reality only such substances as formic acid are the true substances of life. If you examine the deadly nightshade or belladonna, you will see that there is a poison, a deadly poison in it. But what is it that this plant is doing? Specifically, it is collecting a spiritual element present in the cosmic environment. Poisons, generally, are the collectors of such spiritual elements. For this very reason, poisons can also serve as remedies used to effect a cure. And, understood on a very basic level, flowers are continually getting sicker and sicker, and these little bees, wasps, and ants continually play the role of doctor, bringing formic acid to the flowers, which they need in order to be healed completely again. You see, these bees, wasps, and ants are not simply robbers. At the same time, they bring to the flowers the possibility of remaining alive. And it is the same with the caterpillars. They would die out, would simply not exist any more after a certain period of time. Well, you might say, that wouldn't be such a great loss. This type of caterpillar would simply become extinct. But then you need to consider that birds eat them, and so forth. All of nature is interrelated in this way. When we observe, for example, that ants penetrate everything with their formic acid, we have obtained an insight into the inner workings of nature's ecosystem. This is something that is truly very grand. Everywhere things are happening that are absolutely necessary for maintaining life and the existence of this world. You see, there is a tree, drawing on blackboard table 11 in the middle. The tree has its bark. Then the bark begins to rot after I've cut it down. There is the mold. Now people say, just let it rot. So the people calmly stand by and watch everything that remains in the woods simply rot away. And what is it that doesn't rot away during the course of a year? Leaves and similar matter. People just let all these things decompose. But in nature, these substances have been organized differently. Everywhere in the vicinity, there are ant hills. Originating from these ant hills, table 11, upper right, formic acid finds its way into the forest soil. If you have the floor of a forest over here and an ant hill over there, it would be the same as taking a glass full of water and putting a drop of something into it. It simply expands to fill the entire glass. If you put salt into it, all of the water at once becomes salty. Table 11, lower right. If you have an ant hill there, then the formic acid seeps in similar fashion into the floor of the forest. The entire forest floor, which is dying off, becomes saturated with this formic acid. In this way, formic acid reaches the forest floor, which is dying off, but it also penetrates the living plants. We have also considered how a plant takes up formic acid, or bee, or wasp poison. As, for instance, when a bee sits on a flower, and the flower sucks up what it can get from the bee. And we have also considered how a caterpillar needs formic acid. It is possible to determine all these things only if you learn to apply the methods of anthroposophic science. Traditional physical science is concerned only with that which the bee takes away from the flower. But bees wouldn't have been able to sit on flowers for the past few thousand years if they hadn't cultivated them by nibbling at them to keep them healthy. The same is true for all the lifeless material you can find in the forest. Imagine, gentlemen, even today's physical science, at the state of knowledge it has now, assumes that the time will come when everything on earth will be completely dead. It would have to say this, because at some time in the future a condition would be reached when material destroyed by mold would prevail, and the earth would have to be considered dead. But this time will not come, because the earth's soil, wherever it has become moldy, is saturated with that which the bees, wasps, and ants give it. To be sure, bees give it only to living flowers, and wasps almost always to living flowers. But ants also give, in what they transmit as formic acid, something directly to rotten, dead material. And by doing this, they stimulate life to a certain degree, and they contribute to the fact that the earth, in its decaying substance, remains alive at all. You could really say that the spirit that is present and prevails in all these things is certainly one to be marveled at. But as you examine this matter more closely, you can see that it all has great significance. Let's now look at the agricultural ants that set up their little fields, where they grow and tend their plants very differently. It is true that a human being would not be able to exist on the amount of food they grow there, for if a human being were to try to eat these little rice kernels that are as hard as pebbles, the person would first of all become strangely ill from ingesting too much formic acid. But besides this, the individual would probably break off some teeth, so that a dentist would have to work hard for some time to repair them. After that, the person would experience a miserable death, all because of eating these pebble-hard rice kernels that the ants have prepared in this manner. But the ants, more accurately, the entire ant colony, says to itself, if we simply go out into the open fields of nature and suck out of the plants that substance which we find present everywhere, then we will not be able to create within ourselves sufficient formic acid, and as a result we won't be able to give enough to the earth which depends on it. So we'll do it this way. We'll choose specific plants, which we will grow and harvest in such a way that the resulting food will be very tightly compressed, pressed together so much that it becomes as hard as stone, and from this we'll be able to extract a large amount of formic acid. These agricultural ants do this in order to produce as much formic acid as they possibly can. And these particular ants are the ones that manage to put a lot of formic acid back into the soil. This is the connection I've wanted you to see. In this way, you will also understand that poisons, even though they create inflammations or similar conditions, also function as chemicals that have continuous curative powers that stave off the process of dying. You could also say that the bee, in particular, is extremely important in this regard. The bee helps maintain the existence of the flowers. It keeps them from dying out. This is why there is such a deep relationship between bees and flowers. This maintenance of life becomes evident every time insects move about, carrying on their activities on the earth. When this happens, I would like to say that the earth has had its store of poisons replenished, which means, of course, that death has been prevented and life has been maintained. This is the spiritual connection. When someone asks what the spiritual connections are, I never like to say that it is simply this or that way, but rather I prefer to present the facts, and then let a person decide, based upon the facts, whether the connections make sense or not. The facts are usually arrayed in such a manner that you will see that there is significance and meaning in all of them. Unfortunately, those who consider themselves true scholars don't really tell you this. But in life, this does play a certain role. In the areas where we live, less respect will perhaps be accorded to all that I have said. But as you go farther south, you will hear farmers, simple people, say out of instinctive knowledge, these ant colonies, you must not disturb them, because they keep mold from becoming too destructive. And the very smart ones also say something else. If you go for a walk with them through the woods, where trees have been harvested and young trees are beginning to grow, these people, using their noses, they are very smart with their noses, walk through such an area and come to a place where they say, "Well, that's going to grow very well. The moldy odor is not as strong here, so there must be an ant colony nearby that is doing its job." This is what such people can smell. Based on a finely attuned sense of smell, many a farmer's sayings has been formulated that has proved to be very useful. Unfortunately, our modern civilization has become too much of a brain-oriented culture, where the mechanical, abstract aspects of thinking are emphasized, much to the detriment of these instinctive methods, which now have become simply words and nothing else. These creatures, specifically when they appear as collective groups, as in the beehive or ant colony, know all of this. This knowledge is obtained through a very special sense of smell. And as I've said, much of the instinctive knowledge that human beings have is based upon the intelligence of the nose. Next week, we will continue this discussion. The main point I have wanted to make today is that bees, wasps, and ants do not simply remove something from nature, an activity that makes them appear to be robbers, but they also give nature the possibility to continue living and thriving. The end of Lecture 7.